Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Matt John. Welcome to New Books in American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Matt Johnson, and with me today is Michael Staub, professor of English and American Studies at Baruch College, City University of New York, to talk about his new book, Mismeasure of Minds, Debating Race and Intelligence Between Brown and the Bell Curve. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so You've written several books, and the most recent, Madness is Civilization, is an intellectual and cultural history of mental illness. So what led you into this really contentious world of race and intelligence?
Well, this project really grew out of that prior book, Madness is Civilization, which was published by University of Chicago Press some years ago now. And that study had been an examination of a widespread conviction among psychiatrists that mental illness was largely a consequence of social factors. And that research put me on the trail of tracking popular media discussion about the social and affective neurosciences, which have become so popular in the 21st century, and efforts to use brain science to explain just about everything in human existence. And this research both fascinated and horrified me in equal measure, but the fascination led me fairly quickly to look at the longer history of social psychological experimentation and psychological theories into human nature that dated back to the 1940s. And that led me, after some searching, to the Brown v. Board decision of 1954, which really was the spark here, because the Brown v. Board decision, the desegregation Supreme Court decision, relied so heavily on the so-called doll preference experiments conducted by Kenneth and Mamie Clark, which very briefly, for your listeners, in case they're not familiar, the Clarks presented segregated Black kids with two dolls, one Black, one white, but otherwise identical. And the Clarks asked the children a series of questions, such as which doll was friendlier, which doll looked bad, and so forth. And the Clarks used the data they collected from the doll tests to conclude that segregated Black kids had internalized a form of self-hatred. And it was this evidence that became key to the Brown Supreme Court decision, that segregation itself was a kind of toxic space that that really harmed the abilities of Black children to achieve in academic settings. And while most scholars have really seen the Brown decision, which it was, as the culmination of a century-long effort to desegregate schools, I also found that it was the beginning of another story, which briefly was a incredibly nasty racist backlash, the terms of which I think we still live within today, and which remains defined in many cases by the uses and in some instances the misuses of psychological data.
Yeah, and so you mentioned Brown and as the kind of start of this book, and you know, a lot of your this book is in the post-World War II era, and these big changes that begin to happen in research. And so I thought it would be helpful for the listeners who aren't familiar with this history to talk a little bit about what are the dominant ideas about race and intelligence leading up to Brown.
Yeah, Brown really was a turning point in that sense because, and I would recommend your listeners find Stephen Jay Gould's masterpiece from the mid-90s, the second edition of his book, The Mismeasure of Man, where my title is obviously an adapted version of, because in the pre-war, the pre-World War II era, you have a very different universe when it comes to understanding race and intelligence. For one thing, the measurement of intelligence, which dates back to the first decades of the 20th century, really began as not as a predictive tool. In other words, to understand how a child would evolve intellectually over the course of his or her life, but really as a diagnostic tool to just understand how to help kids better learn if they were experiencing difficulties. But then when the concept of IQ, which originates in Europe, sort of comes across the Atlantic to the United States, it really very rapidly became politicized and racialized. And I'll just give you a few quick examples. You have psychologist Henry Goddard, who conducted IQ tests on immigrants at Ellis Island in New York City in the first decades of the 20th century. And he found, again, perhaps unsurprisingly, since so many immigrants were not especially fluent in English, that a remarkably high percentage of immigrants were showing signs of mental deficiency. You have Stanford psychologist Lewis Terman, who argued that IQ testing could be used to track children in schools and to screen applicants for employment. And perhaps most dramatically, you have Harvard psychologist Robert Yerkes, who, together with Goddard, persuaded the U.S. Army during World War I to conduct IQ tests on every single man who had been drafted to the war, which was approximately 1.7 million men. And the data, they contended, showed that men who came from Northern European heritage had superior intelligence to men who were of African descent. And then in the 1920s, you have a series, the Army mental test get used for a series of federal legislative moves to severely limit emigration from around the world, especially from so-called, quote, undesirable regions, in other words, non-Northern European regions. And in 1924, there's the Johnson-Reed Immigration Act, which had severely restrictive quotas on people from Eastern and Southern Europe, but also from entirely banned people from the Middle East, from vast stretches of Asia, including Japan and India. And the other key point here, in terms of where the psychological community fits into this discussion, is that virtually every single leading psychologist, including a man named G. Stanley Hall, who was perhaps the preeminent American psychologist of the pre-war era, used their expertise to argue that intelligence was fixed at birth. So that's really the state of debate leading into World War II, when everything changes.
Yeah. And so you start to talk, when these big changes happen, you talk about this kind of shift towards an environmentalist, egalitarian kind of perspective. So what does that mean for our listeners?
Well, first of all, let's talk about why it changes. It changes because of German Nazism. It changes because eugenic thinking and racial biological thinking, I don't mean it gets an extremely bad rap due to the final solution, the effort to exterminate European Jewry, the effort to exterminate disabled persons. And there's a dramatic recoil. There's the reaction against eugenic ideology, which is severe and intense and completely changes the terms of conversation, also, of course, among psychologists. So in the post-war era, you have a whole new generation of psychological thinkers. A few notable names, Donald Hebb, who was at McGill University, Joseph McVicar Hunt, who was influenced by the educational theorist Maria Montessori, Benjamin Bloom, Alison Davis, and a host of others, who begin to argue quite persuasively that it doesn't matter where the child comes from, poverty, it doesn't matter. Any child born into any circumstance is fully capable of making dramatic scholastic improvement given appropriate educational enrichment opportunity. So you have this rapid change in the late 1940s and through the 1950s. So you have Hebb arguing, for example, quite famously in 1949, that any difference in IQ tests between white and black quite obviously is the result of differences in educational opportunity. It was simply common sense. You have Alison Davis arguing through the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, that any difference in IQ between white and black had nothing to do with biology and everything to do with inequities in social and economic structure. You have Joseph McVicar Hunt saying that improving a kid's environment is going to lead automatically to substantially faster rates of intellectual development. It becomes this much more optimistic view of human nature, the fact that the brain is plastic and that especially young brains can learn and gain dramatically given the right environmental factors, becomes a virtual consensus by the early 1960s, which is, of course, a complete reversal of what had been argued leading up to World War II.
Yeah, and despite the fact that this has so much, this environmentalist egalitarian position becomes so popular and gains so much power, one of the things that you show in this book is that racialist position never goes away. And there's this constant tension throughout this book that you bring out between the environmentalist egalitarian perspective and the racialist perspective. And one of my things that I'm really interested in is why has this racialist position had such staying power in the post-World War II period?
Yeah, that is the $64,000 question, isn't it? Which is, why does something which I'm just going to label pseudoscience maintain staying power? And why do ideas that have no basis in scientific research or empirical evidence nonetheless have a life all their own? I mean, that's a tough question, and I think there are multiple factors that go into it. But in the United States, in the case of the racialist position or the biological determinist position, I think there are several reasons overall for its longevity. And for example, in the book, I refer to the biological determinist position as a kind of zombie science. In other words, it's a position that has really refused to die or that has died many times and yet has somehow kept coming back to life. And I think one reason has to do with the way that the advocates of racial pseudoscience have presented themselves. They have often and repeatedly presented themselves as the only ones who are really willing to speak truth to power. In other words, they kind of self-reflexively take on board the idea that they are the taboo breakers. They are the ones who are finally willing within the field of the psych sciences to deliver the unpleasant, uncomfortable truth that no one else seems to have the guts or the willingness to say. That, in other words, there are really innate differences between races. And so you have, and he's a key figure in my narrative, a man named Arthur Jensen, who taught at Berkeley, an educational psychologist. And he repeatedly used the strategy. In other words, he regrets to tell us the truth that there are these innate differences. You have Charles Murray, who after his colleague Richard Herrnstein, a psychologist at Harvard, dies in 1994, shortly after their collaborative book, The Bell Curve, is published. Murray has repeatedly used the strategy, and others who have championed the biological determinist position have repeatedly used the strategy. But of course, the truth of the matter is the exact opposite of what Arthur Jensen, Charles Murray, and others have presented. In other words, there is no taboo that they are breaking. What they are doing is really restating, with the addition of a lot of footnotes and some academic pedigree, what is in truth a very old position, one that dates certainly back to the 19th century and has its roots in eugenics. That cast inequalities in society as somehow natural, quote unquote natural. And in a way, I think there's a perverse kind of nostalgia here. In other words, they're looking back to an old order, a so-called time where everyone, again, quote, knew their proper place with the whites in control and everyone else sort of in a pecking order under white jurisdiction and authority. So it has a kind of appeal, I guess you can say, and a tradition that has not been successfully driven out of existence. And perhaps, I mean, I hate to be the bearer of unhappy news, but perhaps never really will be driven completely out of existence.
Yeah, one of the things that I love about this book is that it of course spends a lot of time talking about how this sort of research impacts minority groups in the United States. But one of the fascinating things that you bring out is that just how much anxiety this new research produces among the kind of white middle class about how worried they are about what this means for their own children and their kind of obsession about learning difficulties. And this kind of really comes out in this chapter you have, which I think is my favorite chapter about Ritalin, right? And so, I mean, so how does, you know, racial politics play into these debates around, you know, stimulant drugs and hyperactive children? And how does that kind of play into this argument that you have about whiteness?
Yeah, this was a fascinating research project, the chapter on the history of hyperactivity and stimulant medication and its uses, which date back to the early 1960s, really. And it's a slightly complicated story, so it may take me a couple of minutes mm-hmm. to sort of unpack it. But basically, the story begins with psychiatrists and pediatricians noting in the early 1960s that hyperactivity, which went by a variety of names, which I'll get into in a moment, was far more widespread than had previously been thought. And what's interesting about that is that there was no real way to measure or detect hyperactivity in children other than observation. And in terms of the symptoms that would allow or have a child be diagnosed with hyperactivity, I'll just list a few of them because they're incredibly vague. And for example, a child could be diagnosed with hyperactivity if the child, for example, can't sit still or talks too much or can't stay with things or is unpopular with peers. I mean, this is the kind of checklist that pediatricians and psychiatrists were using to diagnose hyperactivity in kids in the early 1960s. So in other words, you have a situation where almost any child at some point could be perceived as demonstrating a symptom which could gain that child a diagnosis of hyperactivity. And perhaps unsurprisingly, given the broadness and vagueness of the category, you have a dramatic, really tremendously dramatic rise in diagnoses of hyperactivity in the course of the 1960s. And along with that, you have a dramatic rise in the prescription of stimulant drugs, and particularly the drug Ritalin. So basically, what I began with this chapter was a question: which children were getting diagnoses of hyperactivity, which children were being treated with stimulant meds like Ritalin, and which children were not getting Ritalin prescriptions, but rather getting a different diagnosis entirely, and were being tracked into remedial classrooms, for example, or special education classrooms. And this is the fascinating thing, because the historical record reveals two completely divergent stories. One is the story of what people at the time, observers and participants at the time, believed was happening in terms of diagnoses of hyperactivity and stimulant drug treatment. And the other story, the second story, is what historians of medicine, decades after the fact, have reconstructed in terms of what the evidence shows, what really happened. So let me tell you the facts of the case first. It was predominantly white, middle-class boys who were getting diagnosed with hyperactivity, or what was called at the time minimal brain dysfunction, or MBD, a condition which had been promoted by psychologists precisely so these boys would receive drug treatments and would not be labeled cognitively challenged and would not be tracked into special education classrooms. And at the same moment that white middle-class boys are getting diagnoses of MBD, or minimal brain dysfunction, and getting Ritalin, you have black children, poor African-American children, with many, if not identical, set of symptoms, getting a completely different diagnosis and getting treated very differently. So, for example, the diagnosis was called mild mental retardation. My colleague, Mikal Raz, has written a book called What's Wrong with the Poor, which I recommend to your listeners if they're curious to learn about that history, about the evolution of the term mild mental retardation. But so black kids and white kids are showing similar, if not virtually overlapping and identical symptoms, and are getting classed differently. So what I realized, or what I learned, and a key takeaway of this chapter, is that an entirely new disease category is invented to label the learning difficulties of white mm-hmm. middle-class kids, which in and of itself seems like a powerful admission of the absurdity of purportedly different differential racial IQs. So as you said a moment ago, it reveals how anxious white parents and white folk were to not get that stigmatizing label, so much so that the medical profession sort of obliges and creates a new disease category, which comes with this treatment, this drug, stimulant drug treatment. So in a sense, the whole history of hyperactivity cannot really be told apart from its racial roots, in a matter of speaking, is what I learned.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that comes out in this chapter too is kind of African Americans' response to the drug prescription of Ritalin. I mean, what does that story look like?
Right. Yeah. See, that's the other part of this that is, I think, so interesting is that, again, as I mentioned a moment ago, in the moment in the 1970s. While the truth of the matter, as historians of medicine perhaps have certainly demonstrated, it was white children who were getting prescriptions for Ritalin, while children of color tended not to get those prescriptions or that diagnosis that would lead to those treatments, but were getting a different diagnosis. At the time, the opposite was actually understood to be the case. So you have the black community arguing across the country. It begins in Omaha, Nebraska. It spreads to Minneapolis, to Brooklyn, and elsewhere. You have a kind of national sort of outcry that, in fact, children of color are being targeted by teachers and counselors for Ritalin for Ritalin treatment in order to make them more manageable. In other words, there was a widespread belief in the 1970s that African-American children were being overprescribed Ritalin, specifically as a sort of racist form of social control. And this leads to a Senate subcommittee hearing, and it leads to all sorts of a national outcry about the overprescription of meds to black kids. Now, meanwhile, SIBA, the Swiss manufacturer of Ritalin, is running ads, monthly ads, in all sorts of psychiatric and pediatric journals. And these ads have photographs of the most likely candidate for a diagnosis of minimal brain dysfunction, and the child who is therefore should be receiving their drug, their patented drug, Ritalin. And every single advertisement during the 1970s that SIBA ran to promote Ritalin portrays only white boys. So they knew what they were doing. At the same time that there's a national outcry over the perceived sense that black kids are being overprescribed stimulant meds. So there's this disconnect there. And in that climate, you have the psychological community, you have all these well-meaning psychologists, and they're watching this happen. And they're watching the fact that it's white boys, white children who are getting stimulant med prescriptions. And they're watching black kids getting overdiagnosed as having mild mental retardation and being sent to remedial classrooms. But in a matter of speaking, it became virtually unsayable to argue that African-American children were being underdiagnosed for hyperactivity because of the deep skepticism at the medical profession more generally, which I think, you know, historically, for a host of reasons, which extends far beyond the research that I've done and that many scholars have documented, was really quite legitimate. It was quite legitimate to be skeptical, shall we say, if not horrified at the notion that medical science really was a kind of move towards social control. I don't mean to undermine the legitimacy of that outcry, but it did sort of tilt the debate in a certain direction. And I think, you know, as I also track to the present day, this remains the case. I mean, in the 21st century, African-American youth are still receiving diagnoses of ADHD, what becomes in the 90s ADD, and then attention deficit disorder, and then ADHD, also in the course of the 90s, that black youth are still receiving diagnoses of ADHD. At the present day, it rates only two-thirds of white children. So the legacy of this history remains with us. It persists to this day.
One of the other great findings in this book is that when you're looking at a lot of these researchers, not everyone you talk about are the Clarks in the Brown case, who are really thinking about race as they're conducting their research and writing up their findings. And yet their findings get pulled into this debate about race and intelligence. How does that happen? Does it really speak to just this power of race that almost everything is pulled in?
Well, I think that, that's a great question. And it's not easy to sort of parse exactly how this happens. It happens for different reasons at different times. But perhaps one key reason had to do, I mentioned him a moment ago, Berkeley psychologist Arthur Jensen, who I mm-hmm. think has maybe been forgotten in ways that, say, Herrnstein and Murray, because of their book in the 90s, The Bell Curve, sort of has a continued kind of currency in terms of understanding its import. But Jensen, in the late 60s and through the 1970s, was a really important, really powerful force to contend with. And a lot of the people that I research, and I'll get to them in a moment, really felt on some level either actively needing to use their research to argue with Jensen, or found their research being used to argue with Jensen. And you know, Jensen basically was an early and very avid promoter of the racialist position of the bell curve through the 1960s and into the 70s. And he wrote often many, many different opportunities to argue that even if you were to change the environment, in other words, improve the environment that African-American children were living in, that those children as a group would maintain a lower average IQ than white children due to innate genetic difference. And really remarkably, in retrospect, he had the chutzpah to argue in Life magazine around 1970, just to give one example, that this news that black folk on average had lower IQs than white folk should actually be understood as comforting to African Americans, because they should understand that their lower IQs meant that if they did not succeed in life, at least they would know it was due to their genetic inheritance, not due to their effort. So that's the level at which Jensen was making a very public and very sort of public relations campaign. And so many of the psychologists that I researched, or many of their proponents, people who took up their research, really saw it as important to counter Jensen in some fashion. And then by the 1990s, when Herrnstein and Murray published their book, which, in other words, The Bell Curve, which begins to argue for what they call cognitive stratification. In other words, that there's a, quote, natural tendency for people of higher IQ to rise socioeconomically, while it's also, quote, natural for people with lower IQ to drift downward on the socioeconomic scale. You once again have psychologists and increasingly neuropsychologists or neuroscientists taking on that as a challenge and arguing against it. So just to give a few examples, you mentioned in your question that there were all the psychological research that would seem on the surface to have nothing to do with race mm-hmm. or intelligence, but got pulled into it. I mean, just to throw out a few examples, you have Martin Seligman's research on learned helplessness, which he begins conducting in the 60s. You have Julian Rotter, who research on locus of control, which is taken up by another psychologist named Herbert Lefcourt in the 1960s. You have something called the interpersonal expectancy effect, which is better known as the Pygmalion effect, which was developed by a Harvard psychologist named Robert Rosenthal. You have debates around impulse control and deferred gratification, which was developed by Walter Mischel, a Stanford psychologist in the 1960s and 70s. It gets taken up by Daniel Goleman in his book on emotional intelligence in the 1990s. And in each of these cases, I found that although it would seem on the surface that these psychological theories would not really have anything much to do with race or intelligence, they do get sort of sucked into the vortex of becoming part, very much a part of that discussion, almost immediately, if not immediately, they become part of that discussion as a way to sort of counter the Jensen argument that I mentioned a moment ago, and then later the Herrnstein-Murray position in their book on the bell curve. So psychological research sort of gets pulled into this debate in a very active way. And it does actually have significant policy consequences. I think that was one of the things that I found most interesting and important about this research, is that it would seem that these theories would exist sort of outside of public policy, but they get pulled into it. I mean, Daniel Patrick Moynihan and his now infamous study of 1965 uses gratification delay, the ideas of Walter Mischel I mentioned just now, as part of his argument about the sort of pathologizing of Black youth, that the Black youth lack impulse control and therefore are not able to achieve at the same level as white youth. So he cites Mischel. You have a variety of studies, policy studies and debates around intelligence testing in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, which turn to some of the theories I just mentioned in order to make their policy arguments. So it becomes kind of deeply imbricated in policy and educational reform efforts.
Yeah, well, I'd love to end just by talking about this great line that you have in the intro that you come back to over and over again throughout the book. And this is what you write. It becomes apparent that there is a mismatch between the measurement tools used by all sides in the battle over race, class, education, and intelligence, and the enormity of the social and political inequalities that form the constant backdrop to the debates. So what does this mismatch look like that you're writing about?
Yeah, I mean, this is part of something I discuss in the book as sort of part of a wider historical phenomena, which other scholars have called the disappearance of the social in social psychology, and which I also adapt as the disappearance of the social more recently in neuropsychology or the social neurosciences. Because the agony of all these discussions is that the real problem has been and has always been rampant poverty. And the difficulty that progressive-minded policymakers and psychologists have had in terms of making a persuasive and successful argument for educational intervention, supplementary educational opportunity, enrichment opportunities for disadvantaged children. And there's always been the worry that if the emphasis is placed on toxic stress, the toxic stress of poverty, for instance, and the deleterious impact that poverty has on the developing brain, that this could lead actually inadvertently to further paralysis and inertia, a kind of blaming the victim perspective. You know, in terms of this mismatch, I mean, what one sees, I think, in looking at this history is that this research about, or this endless talk, excuse me, this endless talk about whites being smarter than blacks, which is nonsense, has had two main purposes. So first, to soothe white egos, even as white economic horizons have been increasingly restricted. And second, to redirect funding away from public schools. And thirdly, perhaps also just to redirect discussion and debate away from the key issues, which involve social conditions, the environments in poverty, and the structural racism that has long been a part, a core part of American culture and society. So psychological data has always had difficulty because it's so inexact. And so it's increasingly not been able to take fully into account or even to acknowledge fully the rampant poverty aspect of this as it becomes more cognitive and more interested in individual attitude and so on. So just to choose one recent example, which I touch on in the book, but really extends beyond it, would be the dramatic rise of positive psychology in American life since the turn of the millennium, a movement pioneered by psychologist Martin Seligman. Because what you see here is really a kind of trans-historical analysis. You have the argument here that the idea that the things are the way they are because people are wired to be a certain way as human beings, and they're not another way because that's not how people are wired. And this has a genuine appeal. It's comforting in a way to a lot of people to believe that we're wired a certain way. But it sets aside all these other aspects, all these social and socioeconomic aspects, and it simply puts them outside the frame of discussion. And the focus then is really more fully on attitude, individual attitude, and what is going on cognitively inside the self, rather than situating the self more fully in a very complicated and unequal economic, socioeconomic world that we all, of course, inhabit. So it's a redirection of conversation. It's a redirection of debate. And while there are certainly psychologists who have pushed back against these sorts of analyses and this sort of trend of the, as I said, the disappearance of the social, that is the trend. And it has been difficult to really push back against it as fully as perhaps those of us who are committed to social change would like to see. And, you know, that's sort of where the story ends. It's kind of at a stalemate, I guess you could say, in the 21st century. You do have those who are making the effort, and then you have the rest who are, for lack of a better word, either more befuddled, more confused about how to use psychological data. And it's a difficult impasse. And I'm not sure that the neuroscience revolution has really overall pushed the discussion in really further in the right direction, in the direction we would all like to see, which is addressing racial inequality, socioeconomic inequality, and so on.
Yeah, I think you're right. Michael Staub, this is a fascinating book. Thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
The book is Mismeasure of Minds, Debating Race and Intelligence Between Brown and the Bell Curve. Thank you for joining us on New Books in American Studies.